Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We've got a special request this week. Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington is one of NPR's most popular podcasts. You might have heard it on the air, and right now they're raising money to keep the stories coming. Stories about people in unusual circumstances, people who find themselves in unexpected places, and people who learn something new when what they've counted on disappears. If Snap has become a favorite of yours, step up now and support NPR storytelling with a beat. Make a contribution right now at Snap Judgment. .org, and thanks. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we're tucking into a comfy chair with a hot mug of tea and a little blanket over our legs, and we're looking ahead at fall books. The great novels you have to read, the new authors you have to find, and perhaps the memoirs we're all hoping will be really dishy. Then we'll poke around for a while looking for clues about some of our favorite detectives. We'll talk about our favorite sleuths and stories, and we'll try not to spoil a thing. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week for our special book discussion, Barry Hardiman. Barry Hardiman, what do you do at NPR?
I am an editor at Weekend Edition.
And as if that's not enough book love for one episode, we also have with us this week our friend Margaret Willison. Margaret, we are so happy to have you here. What do you do with your life when you're not on Pop Culture Happy Hour, Margaret?
Well, officially, you can call me a librarian, and then unofficially, in my spare time, I like to say that I run the best 24/7 slumber party on Twitter.
That is really a good description and very accurate. Well said. Well, we're very happy to have Barry and Margaret with us for this book-themed episode. We thought, what better opportunity to get some of our favorite big readers together and chat about fall books. So the first thing I want to ask, and I'll direct this to Barry, because Barry's been working with books for years and years.
They've been propping up my computer monitors forever.
It's true. The movie season, for example, has, you know, you've got your summer movies and you've got your fall movies heading into Oscar season. What does the book year look like? Is there a book year?
There is. I mean, there is, you know, I would say there's definitely, you know, fall is when you get your big goldfinches, when you get your doorstops. It's when you get your big old the literary fiction. There's a lot out there this year. This is the season for of
meatiness.
Festive gladness for Glenn and me and Margaret. And
is that around the fact that people like to sit around in the fall and winter and read?
Is it because of holiday books? Your description with the blanket, I thought, oh yes, that's why don't we all have blankets? Well, it's holiday books
in a big way.
Prizes as well.
It's the end of summer reading, like this, whether or not you actually do light summer reading, reads. It's the way to kind of mark a transition, a change of seasons.
We move into the more serious books of fall. You know, people who listen to the show know that I am only partly a novel reader. I'm a big reader, but not always a novel reader. But Barry, you're a novel reader.
Oh my God, I just finished. I mean, I'm so excited about this book, but this is going to be annoying because everybody is.
Right, of course.
The Paying Guests by Sarah Waters is so good. This is almost the only book I can talk about right now, even though I have other things that I do want to talk about.
For people who are not familiar with either book or author, can you tell us a little bit about this book?
I can't just gush. So I am embarrassed to say that this is the only Sarah Waters book that I have ever read, which is why it's so good that we have Margaret here who can fill in the rest.
Who is giving you a face.
Right, exactly.
Oh,
she's giving me
a happy face.
Yeah, she's blooming like a flower. She's also dressed in flowers, so everything is happening.
So Margaret,
it's like a garden.
Margaret, why don't you talk a little bit about this book/author?
Well, she's basically one of the preeminent lesbian authors of our time, and she's also one of the preeminent Victorian recreationists of our time, which was really my entry point. My favorite of her novels is Fingersmith, which is a really remarkable, twisty little narrative about chambermaid falling in love with her mistress, but also maybe conning her out of her money and into a madhouse.
Ooh.
It's terrific. A great pickup for people looking for a Gone Girl read-alike.
There's nothing more pleasurable for a reader to find a book and then realize that the author has written a lot of other ones. So now my Kindle overfloweth. But The Paying Guest is not a Victorian. Have you read it?
Not yet.
Oh, my God. I can't. I want to be next to you. And maybe even in your lap when you read it. I'll be the blanket.
There's plenty of space right here, Barry. Anytime but, you want.
It takes place in the 20s. It is this amazing, sort of meticulously observed novel of manners and class that blasts into the sexiest, oddest love affair between two women and then into an amazing murder mystery. And what I love, and I don't know if this is characteristic of her, it could be very fussy, but she doesn't shy away from anything. So the sex is really sexy.
Yep.
The murder is super murdery. I could not put it down. I couldn't stop. You know that little dumb thing that everybody's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to highlight stuff in my Kindle? I highlighted every friggin' thing in this book.
Yeah.
So I would also say, as a person who is not, if you're looking for a read-alike Goldfinch, if you must, I loved that the main character was very, you know, this sort of very at home in her skin. She's a lesbian. She's obviously extremely at home in the 1920s in her skin. The book astounded me. I'm sold.
And Glenn, how about you novel-wise? Anything coming up novel-wise?
I've already talked about on this show Lila by Marilyn Robinson. Mm-hmm. Still gets my highest recommendation. What a great book. One that recently came out is The Bone Clocks by David Mitchell of Cloud Atlas fame. Awesome. Like Cloud Atlas, it's a nested narrative with a lot of different time periods going on, a lot of different shifts in point of view, and it's I love a book like this. I haven't read it yet because David Mitchell is not somebody I can pick up every night and read a little bit.
I
do need some time with him because of the nature of the book. So I'm looking forward to Thanksgiving weekend. I've already marked off time for this is exactly what I'm going to be spending that time doing. Uh-huh. Everybody else is going to be at the mall. Idiots. But what I love about him is that when a writer of this kind of ambition and this kind of a prose stylist comes along, the literary fiction community has to allow science fiction and fantasy into their precious little world where we kind of keep it off. So it's not just shunted to this little genre. It's part of it because these themes are actually saying something about humanity. He's doing something smart. At least he did with Cloud Atlas. I'm hoping he does it with this. But this book has been incredibly well reviewed.
Yeah.
So I'm reasonably certain.
I can add to that review and say it was one of the few books I read on maternity leave. I loved it.
Awesome.
Every place he went was a place I thought, oh, do I really want to go? Oh, I do.
There you go. Yeah. Can't wait. And really quickly, I'm going to stand up for a venerated institution that gets a little crap this time of year, which is Best American Short Stories.
Yeah.
Comes out every October, I think. And it is an imperfect institution because this is not a place to get the warp and weft of all short fiction that's going on in the world right now. And, you know, frankly, the one that's coming out next month in October, the names on the back of it look a hell of a lot like the names who are on the back of it 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Your T.C. Boyles, your Joyce Carol Oates, etc. But every year there's a new discovery to make. This year it's being edited by Jennifer Egan. They change authors every year. That's a good sign, right?
Twitter, yeah.
Exactly. And
here go the pips.
It has this marvelous thing in the back where you get the bio of the author, but then you also get a little blurb from them talking about how they wrote the story, what they were inspired by, whatever. Here's the thing about short story writers. They never go on talk shows like novelists do. So you don't really ever get a real good sense of them unless you're, you know, reading interviews with them in some obscure literary magazines. This is a good sort of survey course in who's a jerk.
Yeah.
You can just sort of tell from a blurb if they said something about how they were inspired in the muse. Nope. Thank you very much. You're not for me. If they are funny, if they are self-deprecating, it just kind of warms you to them and to their work. So that's a lot of fun.
How about you, novel-wise, Margaret? Do you have a top of your list?
I'll give you The Sun by Jandy Nelson. It's a young adult book, the sophomore novel of someone whose debut I really enjoyed because it's got some elements that are very... If you hear about them just on the page, you're like, that? Where the protagonist is named Lennon after John. She's a girl. She writes poetry, but then she buries the poetry under rocks in the woods. And normally, this is all stuff. It's like, I'm out, I'm out, I'm out, I'm out, I'm out. But I read this book, and she managed to make a character with those top-line qualities feel whole and organic and believable, and most surprising of all, intensely lovable. So that first book was called The Sky is Everywhere, and it dealt with a sister grieving the loss of her older sister. This new book, I'll Give You the Sun, is about a pair of twins, and it's told from dual narratives. So you start when the two twins are 13, and it's grounded in Noah's narrative, and he is an artist at odds with his father because he's gay and he hasn't come out yet, and he's struggling with that. And the second half is grounded in his sister's perspective when they're 16. She's Jude. She is a beautiful blonde surfer. She's the socially blossoming one of the two. And in between the two periods, 13 and 16, the twins go from being incredibly close to barely speaking to each other. And the central conceit is sort of approaching towards the middle, what happened to make these two people fall apart, and are they going to be brought back together again? I've read only the first couple chapters, but I'm smitten. And that came out last Tuesday on September 16th.
That's wonderful. Cool. That sounds kind of awesome. What else is anything else on your list, Barry? What are you thinking about?
I also wanted to point out, since in the world of nonfiction, that Alan Cumming has a memoir coming out.
Yes, that's on my list.
Oh, is it?
Yes. No,
too.
It's great. It's on my list too.
So I started this today because we're going to have him on our show, and I was sold within 10 pages, if only because it turns out he is one of the Cummings of Cawdor. Yes, that Cawdor, the Thane of. This is a memoir about his father and their difficult relationship. I cannot wait for the plane ride home.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask the most important question. Do you guys know if it's going to be released as an audiobook narrated by Alan Cumming?
Mm. I don't know, but that is an excellent
question.
You have really popped that to the top of the list.
Yeah, haven't I?
You have definitely asked the right question. You know, when I was looking at the fall books, there are a bunch of memoirs I thought looked like they would be interesting. There's a George Clinton memoir. Mm-hmm. It was really funny because I was looking at this list and there are three called But Seriously, So Anyway, and Yes, Please, which are John McEnroe, John Cleese, and, of course, the great and good Amy Poehler.
Sure.
Whose book, I will read pretty much anything that Amy Poehler writes. I think that given her presence in Tina Fey's book, Bossy Pants, it made me think that I would read a whole book for sure about Amy Poehler and where she kind of positions herself and how she feels about whatever she wants to write about. I'm not sure it's actually memoir. It may just be kind of views on life and essays. But whatever it is, I will most definitely read it. And Alan Cumming's was on my list, too, Alan Cumming's memoir. There are a couple of novelists that I do return to over and over again, even though they are not. My novelists tend to be a little bit more pop. There is a new Stephen King horror novel coming out this fall called The Revival, which I think he was saying on Twitter just recently, that's a horror novel. Like, I've done other stuff recently. that's a horror novel. And also there's going to be, of course, the new Grisham. I assume will be the same as all Grisham for me, which is very uneven.
Sure.
Meaning I always feel like I'm flipping a 50-50, a completely fair coin with Grisham, because I really do legitimately enjoy a lot of it. I really enjoyed, this is another one I tend to take in audiobooks, I really enjoyed Sycamore Row, which is a recent one of his. But there are also ones that I just find completely forgettable. And typically what I do with those is once I get bored, I go read the plot on Wikipedia and put the book down, because I want to know what happened, but I've completely given up. So
that's what I do with Sons of Anarchy. Just like rape, rape, and more rape.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Did As You Wish come across anybody's radar?
I actually already have a copy of that. I have a copy of that. That's going to be a whole round of that again.
Okay, that is.
That.
Yeah. Now, has anyone read it? Because that I'm interested in.
I've started to page through it.
What it
Say
is,
more.
What it is Carrie Elway's sort of account of the filming of The Princess Bride. Carrie Elway's played, of course, the Dread Pirate Roberts.
Or Wesley.
So, yeah, that looks great. Andrea Martin has a memoir coming out. The book is called Andrea Martin's Lady Parts. Sure it is.
Not to be confused with Naomi Wolf's Vagina.
Exactly. There's a couple nonfiction books that I'm really looking forward to. The one I've read so far is called The Secret History of Wonder Woman by Jill Lepore.
I was going to ask about that book.
I'm actually reviewing that for Slate, so I don't want to spoil that, but I will say it's pretty good. It is not a straightforward history of Wonder Woman, the character. That book is still to be written, perhaps. not me. But it is a really good reconstruction of the cultural mood that created her. So it's a lot about the debt that this character owes to early 20th century feminism and the birth control movement in particular, because a lot of the people who were sort of related to that were involved in the thing. And there have been lots of studies of William Moulton Marston in comics journalism, but that has a very different slant. This is a much more sort of feminist history, which is really, really interesting. She's also a really good writer. But the one book I'm perhaps looking forward to most this fall is called Dr. Mütter's Marvels. That is a history of the creation and the life of Dr. Mütter, who created the Mütter Museum. Museum.
The greatest place on earth.
One of my favorite places.
The Magic Kingdom.
On the planet. It is it's a museum of cultural oddities written by a Philly girl, Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz. She's also done a play about Mutter. So I'm really, really looking forward to that.
I was going to mention to you, Glenn, too, there's a book by Chip Kidd this fall called Judge This, which I believe is about first impressions. Mm-hmm. And I will be curious about that. I enjoy his I've watched his TED Talk about book covers several
times.
Sure. I'll check that down. That sounds great.
I would read that. What else is on your list, Miss Margaret?
Well, awesome. I actually have both a memoir and a piece of mass market spinner fiction.
Fabulous.
Which would be the little
spinner. Right.
Yeah.
I got you. Spinner fiction.
Because everybody else in the room can see me rotating my finger. They know I'm talking about those twirling racks where they
put
the Shamsel books. And the library. Yeah. So the memoir is Brown Girl Dreaming by Jacqueline Woodson.
Yes.
That's actually been out a little while because I think children's and youth books have like a slightly different awards schedule.
Ah.
And so slightly different prestige releases. So that's
out. And we should mention that our friend Kat Chow did a piece
on a wonderful
her
piece.
With her for Morning Edition last week.
So that came out at the very end of August. I mean, Jacqueline Woodson is a name in and of herself. She's won the Newbery so many times. The ALA was just like, fine.
Yeah.
Take a Lifetime Achievement Award too. Have the Margaret A. Edwards. So it's not like, who's this interesting
newbie
writer?
Yeah.
But it's a memoir in verse, and it's really taking her from her birth in 1963 all the way up to the present day. And I've read portions of it, and it's so beautiful and thoughtful, and I think it's going to be terrific. And then to lower my brow, just a touch.
Of course. We do that here, and we respect ourselves for it.
Absolutely. I'm really excited for a book that came out last week, The Game and the Governess, by Kate Noble. She's a historical romance novelist.
I mean, a governess.
That
please.
Was very wrestling.
Take off your glasses. Let's see your hair.
Governess.
The Game and the Governess.
So she is a historical romance novelist who I've really enjoyed because she does a very good job of bringing humor and tight plotting into the books, which is something that you don't always see in romance novels of any stripe. And she's also of interest to listeners of this podcast because she's a TV writer, too, and has most recently gotten a lot of attention for being one of the main writers for the web series, The Lizzie Bennet Diaries.
Oh, sure.
Of course, sure.
So for that, she works as Katie Rorick. And for this, The Game and the Governess, she's Kate Noble.
Wow, fantastic. You know, you mentioned some of the fine women of the internet. And I have two... with books coming out who are on my list. One is Megan Amram, who has a book coming out called Science for Her, which I have started to go through and is a satirical science manual for ladies. And it is sort of, as I said, it is profoundly satirical and silly. And it goes from, you know, the idea that women need a special science book because they can't understand science the normal way. To clarify yet again, is the idea she is making fun of, not the idea she is adopting. And the other one is Mallory Ortberg's Texts from Jane Eyre.
Sure.
Yeah, also on my list.
Coming out in November. I figured it would be.
Right.
Mallory Ortberg runs The Toast, the website The Toast, and is a lot of fun and has done a lot of these great little series of texts between various characters and famous people. And then the last one that I wanted to mention was actually, there's a guy named Graham Simsion who wrote a book called The Rosie Project, which people kept recommending to me, and I finally got around to reading it. It's essentially, it's a romantic story told from the viewpoint of a scientist who has Asperger's. If that sounds like a very difficult project to write a romantic story from that perspective, it's kind of like if Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory wrote a story about actually falling in love. And if it sounds like that would be a really challenging project but interesting thing to read, it really is. And it is a lovely, charming, I think carefully done and very fair book that does not suggest that the process of finding someone that he can relate to and feel close to means that he no longer has Asperger's or anything like that. It's a really interesting book, and there's a sequel to it coming out called The Rosie Effect.
And I'm always afraid of people writing sequels to novels because you just never know. But this one is one that I think this is apparently the story of them kind of settling in to being together. I think it's a book that I will definitely check out. As I said, it was a book that I kept hearing people recommend and hadn't gotten to reading. Yeah.
Can I do a lightning round of graphic novels? There is Stephen Collins, British writer, artist, did The Gigantic Beard That Was Evil.
Yes.
which I'm reviewing for NPR Books. I don't want to spoil it. It's pretty great. It's kind of Roald Dahl. It's very funny, dark, fable-like, and yes. About exactly what its title says. The Hospital Suite by John Porcellino. He's a guy who does mini-comics, a mini-comic called King Cat, which has a huge cult following, deservedly so. This is a much different book that's a memoir, basically, of his experiences with a lot of undiagnosed illnesses, in addition to his OCD, in addition to his depression, and the time he spends in hospitals having doctors look at him without any kind of result. It is a very heavy subject, but it is done in such a simple, clean style. These drawings are very, very cute. That really takes a lot of the heaviness out of the experience of reading the book, and it's really fascinating and really self-revelatory and very clear-eyed. Really, really well done. Lucy Nicely, who I wrote about on the blog not too long ago, she did the book Relish, a really great comic about food, has a travelogue coming out called An Age of License. Best American Comics is always good. It samples more widely than I think Best American Short Stories does. It's edited by Scott McCloud this year. That's going to be great. But the book I am most looking forward to, the graphic novel I'm most looking forward to, is called Here by Richard McGuire. In 1989, Richard McGuire published this comic, essentially, a six-page version of this comic, in Raw, which was a alt-comics anthology. It is just a one corner of one room being looked at over the course of many different time periods. And he does these really amazing things with the form so that the panel splits so that one year sort of talks to another year, bleeds into another year. Mm-hmm. It was only 35 panels. He has redone it and has gone from 6 pages to 300.
Wow.
So I am curious. I'm a little worried, but I'm mostly curious because this comic was hugely influential. You don't get to Chris Ware's Building Stories without this comic. One little six-page from 1989 is still being quoted visually and narratively a lot. So I'm really looking forward to that. Here by Richard McGuire.
Thank you. There we go. Anything else you want to clean up, Barry?
I'll mention two iterations and series that I followed. One, this is really going to be boring for those of you that know me, but Philippa Gregory has another novel in the Cousins Wars. There are so many cousins, guys. This is The King's Curse. It tells the story of Margaret of Salisbury, one of the last Plantagenets. It's awesome. You know, as usual, it's her usual sort of feminist take on that time, and I do love them. And when it pops up in my Kindle, I'm always thrilled. And then I also want to mention Maggie Stiefvater, who's a wonderful, wonderful young adult novelist who's written quite a bit, but the latest in her Raven Boys series is coming out. It's called Blue Lily, Lily Blue. It's the third in the Raven Boys series, as I said, and this series I love. It's just spectacular. There's a real sort of, she does a great job about talking about money and class in a world of magic, and the magic is somehow, and I mean this as the greatest of compliments, I'm not sure exactly, the magic is somehow mundane in a way that the world is built so well that it seems like, oh yes, of course, that's a thing. So I really, that's another one I'm very much looking forward to.
Thank you very much. Anything else from you, Miss Margaret?
I do. I actually have two more to mention. Surprisingly for me, they're both nonfiction, which is not something I typically read a lot of. One other internet lady of note has a book coming out this fall. Anne Helen Petersen is putting out her Scandals of Classic Hollywood book. But that's a series on the Hairpin that she wrote. You can read a lot of the material there. It's terrific and thoughtful and fascinating. And there will be additional essays added to it for publication. So that's going to be great. And the other one is On Immunity by Eula Biss. And this is sort of half personal essay, half rigorous research on the process of immunization. And it's a writer examining sort of her feelings about it as a mother, and then also just kind of immunization throughout history, fear throughout history, government conspiracies throughout history. And the reason I'm excited about this book, which is very much outside my normal sort of realm of reading, is because this particular writer did a wonderful essay that was published in The Believer called No Man's Land that managed to combine race, the language we use to speak about gentrification, and the legacy of Laura Ingalls Wilder into one long, fascinating, insightful piece. And that's actually still up on the internet as well.
Fantastic. I'm sure that we would be happy to hear from any of you who have ideas about fall books you're excited about. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. So the other thing we were going to talk about today, you know, it's funny. This just happened to be today that HBO announced the new cast members, well, some of the new cast members of True Detective. Theoretically, there's going to be a lady.
As I was going to say, it's two women? Oh, no, no.
Well,
no,
theoretically, right. There's also going to be a lady, but we haven't gotten that announcement yet. What we did get was an announcement of Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn.
Oh.
Which, to me, Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn in the hands of that particular show... I don't know that I need that, but for folks who do, that's what we know, and we're still waiting for more cast announcements. That happened to come today when we were going to talk about detectives. And, you know, I think the way that I was trying to approach this was to think about sort of persona and how much detective fiction and detective stuff, whether it's television or movies or books, is a really personality-driven thing. Because I have spoken on this podcast many, many times about Franny Fisher, who is a lady detective who Barry and Margaret have both just squealed about at the same time.
She saw me through the first 3 weeks of newborn.
Inwardly, I squealed.
On the Australian series, Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, which I think you can still probably find some of on Netflix. And there's a second season, which I think they'll eventually get. But in that show for me... You know, the mysteries are fun. They're fine. I freely admit I don't really care. Like, I'm not in it for the mystery solving. And I think that's true with so many mystery shows. I'm in it for her because she's fun to watch. A detective story is a really good framing for somebody that you like and enjoy and root for to kind of get little wins along the way. You know, you're a detective person, Margaret. When we first brought this up, Margaret's exact words were, "That's my jam." So what detective stuff do you love? In addition to Franny.
I was at a wedding recently talking to another wedding guest, and she was describing, like, a wedding she'd gone to on an island where you had to go out by boats. And I said, that sounds like a great setting for a murder mystery and also a terrific vacation. I realized that like, for me, those two separate categories in the Venn diagram are kind of a circle.
Yeah.
Dream vacations, great setting for murder mystery.
Yeah.
That's also my
anytime,
jam.
Anytime I think someone could get killed here, I'm like, I'm really relaxed.
But I was thinking about why that's true. And, you know, obviously that's not going to be true of every detective novel that you walk into. You're not necessarily going to get this lovely vacation spot. And I was trying to figure out sort of the, one might say, a Weldonian schema.
Yes. One might.
I think it's amateur versus professional.
Okay.
Observer versus intuitor, and traumatized versus impervious.
Yes.
I think those are sort of the three dichotomies that you split
that's
over.
Good.
Fascinating.
Thank you.
That's
wonderful.
So give me an example of intuitor versus observer.
Yeah.
You have Hercule Poirot
is
an observer.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Miss Marple is an intuitor.
Nicely done.
Touché. Touche.
Yeah, I mean, that does make sense to me. I mean, I think even somebody like Sherlock Holmes, you can say has elements of both, but you can see how those are really different parts of what he's doing. That he's an observer, and that the elements of him that are intuitive are kind of odd because because he's so kind of not personable. Then intuition is a strange thing from him.
Yeah. Sherlock Holmes would dispute that he intuits anything.
Sure.
He would say he deduces. He doesn't intuit.
Right.
And in thinking about all of this, what has attracted me to detectives since I was a very small child and my mother called me Miss Marple is specifically the Marpillian trait of using other people's assumptions about your weakness or insignificance as a disguise while secretly destroying them.
Okay. Wow.
So being underestimated.
Yeah, but using underestimation
as a weapon.
Like jujitsu.
Yeah. Yeah.
Columbo.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, essentially Columbo.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Or Veronica Mars also does it constantly.
Right.
Yeah, that people don't expect you to be paying that much attention or to be able to be
this
that
this is like the best
clever.
Class on detectives I've ever taken.
I got started early with Encyclopedia Brown, who as a kid is constantly dismissed.
Right.
And Donald J. Sobel also did Two-Minute Mysteries, these little tiny
Which I love.
And it's
it's really funny. Like, this is already burning itself into my brain. Yeah. Like, Encyclopedia Brown is pure observation.
Absolutely.
And deduction as opposed to intuition, because it's a logic class for little kids. They're not trying to teach you character. They're trying to teach you logic and,
get some character there, especially from Sally. Sally, you get character. From Encyclopedia, you don't. I am convinced that Bugs Meany is just Encyclopedia Brown's Tyler Durden. I'm sure that it's the same dude. That's my theory. Let's. Can I drop a little history on you, ladies? You little ladies. Can I do a little mansplaining?
Oh, yeah, please do. Tell me more.
So the first detective considered the first detective story, Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe, 1841. C. Auguste Dupin, who had a mixture of everything you're talking about, Margaret. He was the first eccentric detective, and he was also an amateur, but Poe described what he did as ratiocination, which is this idea of making logical leaps. And it takes, a good 40 years for us to get to Sherlock Holmes after that. And then it takes another 40 years for us to get to Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, Rex Stout, Ellery Queen.
Josephine Tay.
Sure.
Josephine Tay.
The hard-boiled detective comes from a magazine called Black Mask, which was a pulp magazine. Recently, they've just published a bunch of stories, like 1,116 pages worth of stories, because this magazine ran for decades. And
this is the great thing about mystery. You can get tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of it for
you
free
never
in
come
lots
to
of
the end.
Places.
Yeah. And if you sift through those 1,160 pages, you will find a story where a woman is the protagonist. You will find one where there's actually a Filipino detective or private investigator, which is actually really done kind of sensitively and not Charlie Channing all over the place.
Sure.
But so this is where Sam Spade first appeared. This is where a lot of Raymond Chandler stuff appeared. Both Wittgenstein and Gertrude Stein, all the Steins, were subscribers.
All the best Steins.
Detective fiction was Gertrude Stein's favorite genre. She said it's the most modern of all genres because it moves.
Yeah,
unlike A Rose is a Rose is a Rose, which is kind of And from this pulp tradition of the hardboiled detective is where we get Batman, the world's greatest detective, by the way. But he is.
I was going to say that about Buffy.
Well, but Batman is a power chord, and different authors kind of play that detective note, or they don't. But one of the reasons I love Batman so much is because he's basically Sherlock Holmes with bat ears. I mean, basically, if you're writing him right, he does do all those logical leaps. He has a Watson to kind of bounce off of. He has a proxy to kind of intervene on your behalf. And my half-ass theory with detective fiction, of all detective fiction, is that it is the form that most mirrors the reading process, the fiction reading process, where we are introduced to a thing and we slowly, over the course of the story, learn what happened, where we are. And, that's a topic of Paul Auster in his New York trilogy, kind of does all this meta detective stuff. And there's an interesting thing that happens, too, which is where you are following along with a detective in many, many of these stories. Until one moment, you're not. And then the detective has an insight, he or she, is going to save until the very, very end, and then just do an info dump. That info dump is a big part of this, because you do feel like you're being brought along, and then at some point, just vanishes
point
into the mist.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask, one of the things I was going to ask you guys is, how much do you feel when you read a detective story, if you're going to enjoy it, how much do you feel like you need to feel later like you could have figured it out? Do you know what I mean? As opposed to too much was being withheld for you to have figured it out.
I want a logical leap, but the leap can't be so far that I can't see the path it took. You know, that's really important for me. What I think about, like, probably my favorite novel of all time is Great Expectations, which is a mystery novel. You know, but if you go back, you can see Estella's mother and the hand. Yeah. I think I just ruined this for people. But can see the beautiful hands. You can see the... And that, for me, is the greatest pleasure of fiction. What was the thing I read but I missed?
Yeah.
You need to be able to go back and see, where are the crumbs? I want to eat those crumbs on a second reading.
Yeah. Mystery novels are a gift for know-it-alls.
That's true.
That's a good point.
And one of the reasons that Columbo is as groundbreaking as it was is because it showed us the murder. And then it shows us Columbo piecing it together and making these murderers twist in the wind as he slowly comes back and slowly comes back. It completely inverts the whole process of the info dump. There's still the info dump, but the focus of that is, here's how I figured it out. Here's how I know you're guilty, as opposed to, here's what happened. Because we've seen what happened.
Well, it's interesting to me how much, if you look at something like Law and Order, how much
The second half has nothing to do with the detective story. Right. The second half is a totally different thing. The second half is a legal drama. But the first half is very often, not always, but very often, a fairly straight up detective story with a pretty predictable structure, which is you go down X number of blind alleys and you make X number of mistakes, and then something comes together and you figure it out. And sometimes that detective story continues through the entire episode, you know, through the legal thriller.
You have
you're
to go
still
back.
Getting pieces of the answer to the main crime. But it's funny to me that they've sort of restyled the detective show as, you know, what we now call crime procedurals, which to a great degree, I mean, what are CSI folks other than detectives in pretty much a, not necessarily a classical sense in structure, but a classical sense in notion. And when CBS was doing Elementary, the Sherlock Holmes story that they started a couple seasons ago, when people were asking the question, if you have a BBC, if you have a BBC Sherlock, if you have other versions of, you know, you've got the Robert Downey Jr. movies, why do we need another Sherlock Holmes story? One of the things they said was, and I agreed with, was, look, these are all Sherlock Holmes stories. What do you think The Mentalist is? And in a way, what do you think Psych is? And then, then the great thing about Psych, when Margaret mentioned intuitors versus observers, if you know anything about Psych, Psych is essentially the story of a guy who is an observer masquerading as an intuitor. And it's really fascinating to think of it in that sort of framework.
You know, one thing we haven't talked about in Margaret's schema is the traumatized versus the... And
intuitive.
That, for me, you know, is I mean, this is Wallander from, you know, like, I love someone who's been badly traumatized. unless it's Franny Fisher, in which case it's like she's
and I
nothing
prefer,
can traumatize her.
Right, I prefer impervious in that sense.
Yeah, me too.
But I want to... I mean, this is Batman. You know, I mean, Buffy for me...
Just talking about the scenes we see of somebody like his partner just got killed. Like I think the traumatized lends itself to cliche more easily than the impervious.
I can't do horror. I can't do. It is not often that I love to see a murder, and yet I do love mystery. I need to know that the human was affected. The human that comes into contact with it has been affected by their job. You know, that was what I liked so much about what was the wonderful, the British series.
Broadchurch.
You know, this idea that like that coming into contact with evil changes you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so the impervious is tough for me, unless it has a lot of fringe and leopard. Like Rhiney.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and you know I love fringe and leopard.
Right. You get the occasional author who does a good job of splitting the difference between the two, like with Dorothy Sayers and Lord Peter Wimsey.
Right.
I mean, you go through the majority of those books and he's just doing his job. He's dapper. He's romancing his lady. Everything's fine. And then you get to the point where he finds the criminal and he consistently has a nervous breakdown every single time, has flashbacks to being, you know, in World War I and all of his men dying. And you get to have this sense that you're dealing with human characters, but also this sense that you're entering a safe space where maybe there's going to be some crime, but roughly the good will get their rewards and the bad will get their punishment.
That is a facet of a lot of mystery novels where you don't actually ever fear for the detective. You know, he doesn't, he or she doesn't seem a character who's ever in any danger. This is just a puzzle to be solved. It's very abstract, and it's and there's dead bodies dropping all around. Miss Marple and Jessica Fletcher. The show that also has the alternative title of I Didn't Do It, Aunt Jess. That's the other title of that show. She is a harbinger of death, that woman. Best to run away from her in a cardigan.
Well, again, you know, I would be fascinated to hear what all of you think about detectives. Do you read these kind of novels? Do you have any more modern takes on it?
Do you have a mystery to solve?
Do you have a mystery to solve? Do you have a mystery to recommend? Come and find us on Facebook or on the blog and tell us what you think. So before we get underway with the main part of our happy segment, we are happy to have Barry here and happy to have Margaret here. But this is where we can reveal that hiding in the studio... We do, in fact, have... Are you there?
I am.
Oh, we do, in fact, have our friend Stephen Thompson, who, if you don't know, Stephen is an editor and writer with NPR Music, and he's hiding out in the studio. You know, he was kind enough to show up to tell us what is making him happy this week, even though not around for Books and Detectives. Stephen, what is making you happy this week?
Well, first of all, I'm really glad that Glenn... plugged Encyclopedia Brown, which would have been my contribution not only to the discussion of detectives, but are the books that I have read most recently.
There we go.
Nice.
My other contribution to the discussion you had is that when Margaret mentioned Anne Helen Peterson, I yelled "Bingo! I got bingo!" and and only I laughed in the production room here. But that's the entirety of what my contribution would have been. As far as what's actually making me happy this week, I mentioned last week that my kids have started playing Guitar Hero.
Yes, you did.
And that it led, among other things, to my daughter following Ozzy Osbourne on Twitter.
That's true.
The natural course of events has taken place in such a way that she is now dressing as Ozzy for Halloween.
Aww.
And that we, as a family, sat down and watched Wayne's World.
Okay.
And, well, we watched Wayne's World and Wayne's World 2. And you know what's aged pretty well is Wayne's World. And you know what has not aged very well is Wayne's World 2. But watching Wayne's World together and just watching the kids soak up these characters who are not old and tired to them in the slightest, and among other things, see in my daughter rekindled her love of Alice Cooper, who I dressed as for Halloween when I was 7. So what is making me happy is the way that that everything comes back around.
That is super fantastic.
Is this little girl I cared for?
Yeah.
Sunrise, sunset.
Yeah. Only with Ozzy Osbourne. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week, ma'am?
First of all, the obvious thing that's making me happy this week is to be in Washington, D.C. with all of you lovely people. I even missed your mosquitoes.
It's true. Take all the blood. Take it.
We live in a swamp.
It's true. I will say, Boardwalk Empire has started up again. I don't know if we've ever talked about it on this show.
I don't think so.
But I am a fan, and, you know, Linda and I have had a lot of cubicle conversations about the state of prestige television, and which is bloody and generally anti-woman.
Yeah.
And if there can be somebody crucified by the side of the road,
yeah.
Fabulous. I think Boardwalk Empire earns it.
Sure.
I do not think, I will say for the record, I do not think True Detective does.
Oh, no.
I said it.
Yeah.
It is probably the most beautiful show on television, which I don't even care about that stuff. And yet, every time there is a scene change, I have to stop and say something to my husband. It is a wonderful show. It is coming. This is the last season. You have a lot of homework to do if you have not caught up with it. It's like Deadwood. It is homework. It is. The pleasures are deep and very, very interesting. It is a brilliant show. And then I will also say another, just to add, because, you know, you can't have all those. I mean, that's a lot of blood and guts, even if it does look pretty, is that I went back and rewatched all of Fawlty Towers recently.
Oh, sure.
Oh, wow.
And since you just mentioned John Cleese's memoirs coming out, which I think we're going to talk to him on our show. And I have to say, Fawlty Towers, it is dated.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be in the mood. But it is a real piece of art that it's really interesting to watch, this real sort of Molière type of comedy with a very unlikable main character. To see John Cleese be so unlikable is just really, really fascinating. Prunella Scales is marvelous. It is worth it to watch 7 episodes of Fawlty Towers and then go to your favorite, to Arrested Development, or, you know, and see the way a sitcom has developed. So anyway, highly recommend both.
Awesome.
Wonderful. Thank you, Barry Hardiman. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
You know, a wise man once said that a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds.
Yes.
But as far as I'm concerned, my brain is, my mind is pretty little, and recommending podcasts is a big old hobgoblin.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to recommend a podcast that begins every week like this.
Pitches our perception of frequency.
Pitch is how that note sounds when you hear it.
That is Pitch. It is a documentary podcast on music produced by Whitney Jones and Alex Kappelman. It is, as you can tell just from that sort of audio soundscape, it is very much in the 99% Invisible Radio Lab, This American Life school, and it is incredibly well produced. It is thoughtful. It is immediately engaging. And here's the other thing, 15 minutes long. There you go, right there.
Oh, I love that.
It was recommended to me by a listener to the show, Jeff Mitchell. Thank you for that, because last week I was talking about Kristen Milioti in Once, and there is the most recent episode of the podcast, as we talk right now. It's an interview with Kristen Milioti talking about how to get on stage at Once, she had to basically learn how to play the piano in like a week.
Yeah.
It's just really smart. But the other episode is about something like the Clear Mountain Pause, which is this pause that exists in songs, like Closing Time and Alive and Kicking. And also there's something in there about backing tracks, you know, in live music. There's another one about the Long Box. Remember the Dear Departed?
Yeah.
Not so dear, Departed Long Box.
Yeah.
It's really, really well done. And I love it. So that's The Pitch. It's a podcast that you can download on iTunes. You can go to their website at hearpitch.org.
Wonderful. I would listen to that.
You certainly should.
I'm going to.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Margaret H. Willison, what is making you happy this week, Hula Hoop?
Everything. But to narrow the list down a bit, when I get home from Washington, D.C., I will have waiting for me in my apartment the newest episode of Outlander. And I have been working my way through the books. I will be reading the book on my way back up to Boston on the bus. Then I will get to go home and I will get to watch the episode where Jamie, the handsome Scotsman, finally kisses Claire, the World War II nurse pulled out of time to be with him.
Yes.
Roxane Gay and I have been waiting for this for a long time. She's recapping the show for Vulture.
It's true.
I think I've found the waiting process, like, a little bit less maddening than she has because I'm really there for, like, feisty ladies solving medical mysteries using medicinal herbs.
she's like, get to the, I've seen that.
But I'm not made of stone.
Yeah, of course.
I want to see this as much as the next red-blooded American or Scottish woman.
Yes.
So there's
or
that.
Or man.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. And several people have asked us about that show. So yeah. I'm glad you're mentioning
the
kilts. I'm making light of some of the things, but it is really remarkable. It is beautiful, just like yours. And unlike a lot of prestige television, it is genuinely grounded in a female character's perspective from the beginning to the end. She is so intelligent. She is so confident. She gets to be a lot more active in the TV show than she does in the book, merely because in the book it's actually narrated by her.
Right.
So you get a ton of her character just by osmosis.
Right.
And in this, you get a little bit of voiceover, but mostly you kind of have to see what she's doing with the other characters in the scene. So I've been really enjoying some of the changes they've made there. It's terrific.
Fabulous. Nice. Wonderful choice, Margaret. I have a few little short things. One is, of course, the absolute thrill of having Barry and Margaret here with us. Barry has not been in the room with us for a very, very long time, and it's just absolutely thrilling. And Margaret has never done a whole show with us before, so this is a really, really super exciting week for me and for the show. I saw Margaret last night as we taped this at the Arlington Central Library, and for me to drive to Arlington, there has to be something I really want to see, because Arlington is the worst place to drive on the planet. But I went to Arlington.
And I'm from L.A.
I went to Arlington because constant pop culture happy hour favorite Rainbow Rowell was having an event at the Arlington Central Library. She read from her book Landline. And as I told a couple people and mentioned on Twitter, I kept not being able to find Margaret, looking for Margaret coming in the into the room, because everyone there looked like Margaret in the sense that it was just cute, adorable dresses and great cardigans just in the door and in the door and in the door. Just fabulous, fantastic women, mostly women, not entirely women, but mostly. I wrote a piece on the blog a while ago about what I called book girls, and this was a great event of book girls. And Rainbow is funny, and she'll know what I mean when I say this. She was funny and weird and and sort of is great to see read. So that was exciting. Last Friday night, as we tape this, I got to do an event at the Smithsonian where I was on stage talking for almost an hour and a half, actually, with Shonda Rhimes, who is the creator of Grey's Anatomy and Scandal. And I happened to wind up talking to her on Friday night after this gigantic thing had blown up from a piece that was in the New York Times that had a whole variety of problems with it. And the experience of just meeting this really powerful, interesting person and having this conversation with her and having it go well, even though I was super nervous about it, was really, really exciting and cool for me. And it was something I was very, very glad I said yes to, even though it was somewhat frightening. And then finally, well, I thought this was over, but then this happened to me. She's a cop, she's a
mom. Come on, mom. Oh my God. She's a mom, she's a cop. Mom, cop, cop, mom. Come on, mom, come bad guys come down. Mom, cop, cop, mom, she will turn this car around. She's a cop, she's a mom. So
that is my dear, dear friend, Jeff Alexander, who tweets as M. Giant and wrote at Television Without Pity as M. Giant, and got on GarageBand with his iPad, God bless him, and put together that version of Cop Mom, Mom Cop, the theme song that I invented to the NBC show, The Mysteries of Laura. And I realized everyone in the world is so sick of this, and I thought I was too. But then Jeff sent me that version. Like, the idea that someone would sit there and do this nice thing for you is so much fun. And I was really thrilled. Jeff Alexander, again, M. Giant. I'll link to him on Twitter because he's a fantastic, wonderful person. And he and his wife and their kid are very, very special people to me. And so that was incredibly thrilling. And so thanks to all of you for tolerating one more round
and
of Cop
And that
Mom,
guitar
Cop.
Lick, is that what they're called? Licks? Are they, I don't know. I think that's the whatever that is.
You're the one who listens to the pitch, Glenn.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure learn this. That is perfect. That is exactly right.
He did it right. He did it justice, so to speak. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GHWeldon, WELDON. You can follow Barry at BHardyman, BHARDYMON. You can follow Margaret at Mrs. Friday Next. That's Mrs. Friday Next, all one word. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, REEDY. And our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain. Nick, like Nick, Fountain, like Fountain. And as always, you can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. So thanks so much to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We've got a special request this week. Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington is one of NPR's most popular podcasts. You might have heard it on the air, and right now they're raising money to keep the stories coming. Stories about people in unusual circumstances, people who find themselves in unexpected places, and people who learn something new when what they've counted on disappears. If Snap has become a favorite of yours, step up now and support NPR storytelling with a beat. Make a contribution right now at Snap Judgment. And thanks.